Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have a shocking report on the rise in homelessness in East County and across our region, as well as highlights from a recent forum on what the county intends to do to help communities assist those who are unhoused. Deceptive ads are targeting sheriff's candidate Dave Myers, and we'll have a report on who's funding those misleading ads. A recall on Jif peanut butter has been announced by the FDA due to salmonella poisoning. We'll have details. From California News Service, hear about efforts in Sacramento to protect children from social media abuses. And then on Green Scene, we'll take you to the grand opening of Ildica Park, a new county park in Spring Valley. On Crime Beat, we'll have news about arrests in two cases, the recent murder of an 88-year-old El Cajon woman and a man whose body was found on a Spring Valley trail several months ago. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including the latest on baby formula shipments amid the shortage, a looming world food crisis due to the Ukraine war, global concerns over a monkeypox outbreak, and more. With the weather warming up, we'll have some grilling safety tips to keep in mind. And finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with Roger Scholey, a retired journalist, historian, and author of the San Diego Memories book series. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The 2022 point-in-time count of homeless people in our region reveals some shocking facts. While countywide, the rate rose 10% from January 2020, before the pandemic, to January 2022, in San Diego's unincorporated areas, the number of homeless people was up over 540% to a total of 173 individuals. The numbers also soared in several East County cities, including Lemon Grove, where homelessness was up 72% to 31 individuals, El Cajon, which, despite having shelters and services, still has over 1,300 homeless people, and the rate was up 69%. And in Santee, it's up 488% to 147 people. Only La Mesa, which has done concerted homeless outreach, held relatively steady at just under a 2% increase. In the unincorporated areas of East County, Lakeside saw a rise of over 162% to 63 people. Spring Valley had 60 homeless people, but that was actually a drop of 38%, one of the few areas that went down. At a recent forum on homelessness at the Lemon Grove Library, hosted by the East County Homeless Task Force and Thrive Lemon Grove, moderator Bonnie Baranoff with the East County Homeless Task Force posed questions of four panelists. Chairman Nathan Fletcher with the San Diego County Board of Supervisors, Lieutenant Pat McAvoy with the Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substation, Tamar Kohler, Chief Executive Officer of the Regional Task Force on Homelessness, and Karina Hernandez, Housing Program Manager for the East County with HomeStart, a nonprofit organization. Lieutenant McAvoy explained that due to a court decision called Martin v. Boise, cities and counties can no longer clear homeless camps or arrest people just for being homeless if there are not enough shelter beds available. He says it's a different story if there is shelter available and they refuse to take shelter, but at the moment in East County, that is not an option that we have available. Hence, the new push by the county to collaborate with cities, nonprofits, and other groups to create shelters with services, as well as safe parking locations and more. Kohler says San Diego County has one of the largest continuum care programs among 400 of them nationwide. A continuum of care means bringing together stakeholders, including elected officials, service providers, health professionals, educators, law enforcement, youth providers, domestic violence experts, and more. Some are combat veterans who suffered trauma, noted Fletcher, who's a veteran himself and says, "There but for the grace of God, it could be him." Homelessness can be caused by many factors such as loss of a job, substance abuse, health or mental health conditions, and more. But one root cause stands out: poverty. Fletcher said,
"We have a society where people who work full-time still live in poverty. And that is complicated by the exorbitant cost of housing, by lack of protections often for renters, by the exploitation of workers, and someone becomes homeless. And so I just think as we deal with the reality of confronting the situation of folks on the street, we can never lose sight of what that root cause of it is, because We can do Herculean efforts to get one, two, three, five people off the street, but if that same day that five people got off the street, seven more people became homeless for economic reasons, we're not making any forward progress at all. And so I think efforts around prevention and shallow rent subsidies and flexibles for housing are all really good to fill that gap, but we still want to have a place for people who work full-time can afford to live. And so a lot of issues surrounding that. But the impacts are severe in every community sees. Every neighborhood in San Diego sees it.
Now, Fletcher also noted that the impacts of homelessness on communities, neighborhoods, and businesses are significant. And then he outlined plans to help both the homeless and communities, asking support from residents. Fletcher said the county is making an unprecedented investment in actions to address homelessness, an issue largely ignored by the previous board, which refused to fund shelters or preventative programs for those with things like substance abuse issues.
But I'll tell you, your county is committed in a way like it has never been before. So making sure we step up to do the county's primary role, which is behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse, and we work as partners with our cities. As the cities find the location and site the structures, then we're there to provide the services, and we've got to do more, and we've got to do it faster, and we've got to keep pushing. But it has been the last 3 years of seeing the county government making an unprecedented investment, the largest increases ever in investment in behavioral health, and things we can talk about later tonight that are coming online and are actually going to provide some help and relief.
Now, since small cities like Lemon Grove can't afford a shelter, the county is offering $10 million grants to cities that will provide short-term solutions such as safe parking, safe camping, or shelters. Things like safe parking and camping are options that can work for people who don't feel safe in shelters, such as some elderly individuals and those with pets that aren't allowed in shelters. Chairman Fletcher voiced frustration that people complain about homeless on the streets, and yet those same people often oppose shelters, safe parking, or other homeless services in their neighborhoods. He pledged to work with cities to make sure that sites are safe and secure, and that they don't create blight if cities will support this collaborative effort. Now, the county has recently also opened crisis stabilization centers to help those with substance abuse, often avoiding the need to overburden already crowded emergency rooms. To date, over 1,000 people have been helped by mobile response teams, Fletcher added, noting that the county has adopted a harm reduction strategy that was missing in the past. Now, an example of how outreach can help can be seen in Lemon Grove, where Home Start contracts with the city to do outreach, such as taking homeless people to the DMV to get a California ID card, as well as a Social Security card and a copy of their birth certificate so that they can qualify for housing. The Home Start team members go out with the sheriff, public health nurses, and county eligibility workers twice a month to help the homeless, although there are often long waits for calls as the number of homeless has increased. In addition, psychiatric emergency response teams, or PERT, are also now dispatched regionally to respond to incidents with mentally ill homeless people if they don't pose a threat of violence to themselves or others. Lieutenant McAvoy with the sheriff praised this effort as helpful to law enforcement, and he said, "It's not always a criminal justice issue or enforcement issue. Do we really need to make someone's life worse when we don't need to? And can we really offer them help?" he asked. During the annual point-in-time count, volunteers count as many homeless as they can find who are living on the streets, in vehicles, and in shelters all on a single morning in January, though the actual number is likely much higher. The volunteers also talk with each homeless person to learn why they are homeless and what they need. Kohler, with the Regional Task Force on Homelessness, said this is both humbling and powerful, and despite the early hour, often 5 a.m., many homeless people are grateful to have someone talk to them about their experiences and try to help. She praised Lemon Grove's participation in the count, stating, "Communities like Lemon Grove turn it into something powerful and impactful." Karina Hernandez with East County Homestart explained that the vast majority of East County's homeless are from East County, not somewhere else. They have ties in the community, and they don't want to leave. Supervisor Fletcher noted that while shelters do provide a place to sleep, ultimately, everyone who is homeless needs long-term housing of some sort. Bonnie Baranoff, the forum moderator, agreed. She concluded, "Really, it comes down to housing the homeless. That's it. Get people off the streets." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Mailers landing in mailboxes and an online ad on Facebook contain deceptive messages regarding sheriff candidate Dave Myers. The ads falsely state that Myers is a lifelong Republican who opposes Democratic values, depicting him as a wolf in sheep's clothing. But in fact, Myers is the only candidate in the race who was endorsed by the state and county Democratic parties. He was also endorsed by the Democratic Party in a prior run for sheriff, as well as when he ran for La Mesa City Council. The ads were funded by the Coalition for Public Safety Reform, Training, and Transparency, a shadowy group that has been responsible for other misleading mailers in past elections. State expenditure forms reveal that the coalition paid nearly $49,700 on May 5th for ads against Myers, and that the County Deputy Sheriff's Association of San Diego County, PAC, paid the coalition $49,900 one day later. The Facebook video ad morphs Myers' picture into a demonic-looking image with a dark face. Myers calls the content of the ads lies, adding, "Using blackface to depict a candidate is one of the oldest racist tropes to try and scare the general public." He says that there is racial bias in the sheriff's office, adding, "I'm running to end that." The Deputy Sheriff's Association did not respond to multiple emails and a phone call requesting comment for this story. The ads also accuse Myers of pandering to the gun lobby. Myers was endorsed in his prior campaign by the San Diego County Gun Owners Association due to his concealed carry policy that differed from then-Sheriff Gore's. A court held that Gore's policy violated the Constitution in a lawsuit filed by the same gun group. However, Myers' website also states that he supports regulation of ghost guns to keep the homemade weapons out of the hands of criminals. The local gun owners group did not endorse Myers in the current race. The mailer also states that Myers violated campaign finance law. According to the Fair Political Practices Commission, the Myers campaign did fail to timely report complete information on some contributions due to an error with the online filing system. The Myers campaign later provided the information and the commission did not issue any fines. The current batch of deceptive ads bears strong resemblance to ads targeting Myers in his prior race for La Mesa City Council, including false and misleading mailers with the identical image of a sheep and Myers' face. That 2019 ad, which also targeted Dr. Akilah Weber as well as Myers, was paid for by the Public Safety Advocates PAC. It accused Myers of being a wolf in sheep clothing and council candidate Weber of being a threat to public safety, even though she was endorsed by the La Mesa Police Officers Union. Coast News Group in 2018 reported that Public Safety Advocates got money from the Deputy Sheriff's Association as well as from developers. The same so-called Public Safety Advocates PAC put out a hit piece back in 2014 targeting La Mesa City Council candidate Mary England, despite England having endorsement of La Mesa's police and firefighters unions. Belying its name, the Public Safety PAC had not taken any money from public safety interest groups in that incident, but did take money from developers, a diamond dealer, and England's opponent, Guy McWhirter, who won the race. Myers says the Deputy Sheriff's Association's apparent backing of deceptive and arguably racist ads proves his point on the need for reform in the ranks of local law enforcement to restore public trust. Myers concludes, "That's the reason I'm running, because there is such a lack of integrity." Reporting on KNSJ for East County Magazine, this is John Tidwell.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced a voluntary recall of numerous Jif peanut butter products by J.M. Smucker due to a multi-state outbreak of salmonella infections linked to the popular peanut butter brand. The products were distributed nationally and sold through major retailers and other outlets. Salmonella is an organism which can cause serious and sometimes fatal infections in young children, frail or elderly people, and others with weak immune systems. Healthy people infected with salmonella often experience fever, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. In rare cases, salmonella infection can result in the organism getting into the bloodstream and producing more severe illnesses, such as arterial infections, that is, aneurysms, endocarditis, or inflammation of the heart, and arthritis. The recalled peanut butters were made in Smucker's Lexington, Kentucky facility. Recalled products include the lot codes 1274425-2140425. Consumers should throw away Jif products matching the recall descriptions or return them to the retailer for a refund. Now, if you consumed Jif peanut butter and have symptoms or adverse reactions, you can report these by calling 800-828-9980 weekdays from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
As children grow up, parents and caregivers across California face the difficult decision of how to oversee social media use. But is that decision made harder by a lack of legal protections for children in the Golden State? Mark Berkman is the CEO of the California-based nonprofit Organization for Social Media Safety. He believes Sacramento needs to act now to better protect youth from social media cyberbullying, substance abuse, and even human trafficking.
Our main legislative focus right now is on SAMI's law. Require social media platforms to give parents the choice to use third-party safety software to get alerts when dangerous content comes across their child's social media accounts.
Berkman says the Organization for Social Media Safety has also endorsed pending legislation for better transparency in social media platforms' terms and conditions, as well as protections against companies implementing intentionally addictive features targeted to child users. Berkman has personal experience in leading for change to better protect California's youth, helping pass a first-in-the-nation law.
My co-founder, Ed Eisner, his 14-year-old son was brutally attacked. An associate of the attacker filmed the attack and put it up on social media. And we developed Jordan's Law after Jordan Eisner to deter what we now call social media-motivated violence.
Social media reform activist Frances Haugen became a household name after turning over data from her former employer, Facebook, to the U.S. government. In a recent online discussion hosted by the American Federation of Teachers, Haugen reiterated her position that Facebook and its parent company Meta, which also owns Instagram, WhatsApp, and other platforms, knows the damage it is inflicting on American children and must be held accountable.
No one inside of Facebook came in and said, this is what we want to do. But what they did do is they turned a blind eye. If we hold children's toys to a product liability standard where you need to demonstrate you did safety by design, why aren't we asking the same thing of these virtual products for children, especially as we move into the land of the metaverse?
Haugen explains that rather than acting as a mirror to reflect what already is taking place in society, Facebook instead both amplifies certain ideas over others while also inducing users to act in certain ways. For California News Service, I'm Chance Dorland. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. On May 13th, the grand opening of Ildica County Park in Spring Valley took place. It's located at the corner of Ildica Street and Sweetwater Road, and it's now open to the public 7 days a week from sunrise to sunset. The new park is about half an acre, and it includes a play area, exercise equipment, and a 20-plot community garden. The park was created to give Spring Valley families and residents a new space to play, grow food in the community garden, exercise, meet others, and enjoy nature. On the ground are planted 22 native trees, including 5 live oaks and 17 sycamores, which will eventually provide shade, support wildlife, and help grow San Diego's tree canopy. All the plants at the park are native species and they're drought tolerant. The grand opening included a gardening demo, a walkthrough of the park with the park ranger, and a ribbon cutting. The presentation was kicked off by Brian Albright, director of the county's Department of Parks and Recreation, along with the chair and vice chairs of the County Board of Supervisors, Nathan Fletcher and Nora Vargas. Supervisor Fletcher, whose redrawn district now includes land adjacent to the park, spoke on the values of recreational areas, and gave a preview of some new recreational programs yet to come to help families get out and enjoy the outdoors.
Let's get out and play. There is such a value to getting out and playing. And whether you're going to sit there and play chess or checkers, or you're going to go over and do a couple pull-ups and get a little workout, or the little ones are going to come. Between my wife and I, we have five. But I think it's the place where we come together as community. And, you know, if you make the mistake of opening social media or watching the news, it is so divisive right now. But when you go out and you actually talk to someone and you see them, right, you realize even if you have some differences in who you vote for or where you go, there's still a lot more that holds us together. And that is our love of our kids and our families and our community. And I think you see that when you have the opportunity to come out to locations like this. So I am thrilled to be here. I know y'all have been waiting. I was talking to Veronica and John, and they're like, we've been waiting for like 20 years since they bought the land. Well, I got there about 3 years ago, and we voted and we funded it, and now it's here today. And we're excited about that and really value the partnership with San Miguel High School. Appreciate you all. And the community garden, a vital component of what we're doing. So there is a whole lot to love about what's happening right here. And the final thing I'll say is keep posted for what Brian and his team are doing. We've got hands down the best parks department in the entire state of California. Hands down, not even close. And we're going to have, this is our 13th community park in the last 3 years. Our 13th new community park in the last 3 years. And one thing we're really going to highlight this year is a lot of our regional parks. We want to get you out taking a day trip out to one of our regional parks. Come go for a hike, camp, fish, come out and kayak a little bit, climb a rock, a little rock climbing. And so we're going to do a lot of work for how we can help, you know, get you transported out there. And you know, I think a lot about my mom, early kind of single mom, the notion that she could just go camping when she'd never been camping before. It was daunting. But you know what? We got all the stuff you need to go camping. We got tents and sleeping bags and stoves. And so you know what? We'll give it all to you. And we'll give you a ranger to help you set it up. We want people to have that first-time experience in our regional park. So with that, I'm going to quit talking about parks, and let's get this thing officially opened and kick it off. And Brian, thank you to you and your incredible team and everything we got going on.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat, on the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. 55-year-old Chase Folks has been arrested and charged with the murder of his mother, 88-year-old Carolyn Jean Folks. Sheriff's deputies responded to a call from a man requesting help at their home on Quarto Lane in unincorporated El Cajon May 19th around 1:30 in the morning. They found Carolyn Folks dead in the home with trauma to her upper body. Her son, who was also in the home, was taken to a hospital by paramedics after he complained of pain and was later booked into the county's central jail on murder charges. Two people have been arrested for the murder of Ronald Ray McKinney. The 59-year-old man's body was found by hikers on January 23rd off of Millar Ranch Road in Spring Valley. On May 16th, a search warrant was conducted at the homes of Adrian Carranzo in El Cajon and Brandis Cuesta Marquez in Spring Valley, says Lieutenant Chris Stefan with the Sheriff's Homicide Unit. Carranzo was booked into the county central jail and Cuesta Marquez was booked into the Las Colinas Detention and Reentry Facility. Anyone with information about these crimes is asked to call the Homicide Unit at 858-285-6330 or after hours at 858-565-5200. You can remain anonymous by calling Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is an important step, but it is by no means the only step that must take place.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack welcomed a cargo plane carrying 35 tons of specialty infant formula to Indianapolis Sunday. Other Operation Fly formula shipments will arrive this week to address the nationwide shortage. Several babies have been hospitalized after drinking substitutes or homemade versions. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is warning of an impending world food crisis as Russia blocks key ports. Before the invasion, the two countries accounted for 30% of global wheat exports, as well as much of the world's fertilizer. Zelensky's comments echo those of food supply expert Sarah Menker, who told the UN the world wheat supply is only enough to meet a fifth of global demand.
A level not seen since the financial and commodity crisis of 2007 and 8. We currently only have 10 weeks of global consumption sitting in inventory around the world.
In Japan today, President Joe Biden will discuss expansion of that country's forces in response to China's growing military. He'll also meet with leaders of India and Australia on the second leg of his Eastern Asian trip. Before boarding Air Force One on Sunday, Biden commented on the outbreak of monkeypox in the U.S. and abroad.
It is something that everybody should be concerned about.
One case was confirmed in Massachusetts, and the CDC is monitoring six people who sat near an infected passenger on an international flight. Monkeypox infections have also been spotted in Canada, Britain, and Italy. A New York Times analysis found that 44% of Republican lawmakers in battleground states supported former President Donald Trump's unverified claims of election fraud. It also found almost a quarter of GOP lawmakers in those states tried to delay or overturn the 2020 vote count. Democratic primary results for a U.S. House seat are being slowed by blurry ballot barcodes that counting machines can't read. That's slowing the tally of up to 60,000 votes in Oregon's 5th District contest. A new poll says more than half of Americans favor the continued use of Title 42 to expel migrants from the border. A federal judge has temporarily stopped the White House from ending the public health order. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas is warning the administration's move would increase illegal immigration.
This is extreme, it's radical, it's dangerous, and it's unnecessary. The open border policies of this administration are a disaster.
Democratic Washington Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal argues the order should never have been used.
Title 42 became an overt national immigration and border security strategy that essentially overturned current immigration law and takes away the legal rights enshrined in domestic and international law that migrants have to seek safety and asylum here in the United States.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine on KNSJ with some grilling safety tips. July, August, and right into Labor Day, we use our barbecue grills more than any other months. Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, East County Magazine's in-house fire chief and columnist, says that firefighters respond to many structure and wild land fires that involve barbecues around this time of year. He adds, quote, "We also treat many victims for injuries related to barbecues. Barbecue safety means sending the right smoke signal, and that signal is safety," unquote. While gas grills contribute to a higher number of home fires than their charcoal counterparts, all grills pose a risk for fires and burns. Grills should be placed well away from the home and decks, far from under the eaves or overhanging branches and vegetation. Other grilling safety tips from the National Fire Protection Association are as follows. 1. Propane and charcoal grills should only be used outdoors. 2. Keep children and pets at least 3 feet away from the grilling area. 3. Keep your grill clean by removing grease or fat buildup from the grills and in trays below the grill. 4. Never leave your grill unattended. Always make sure your gas grill lid is open before igniting it. 5. If you smell gas while cooking, immediately get away from the grill and call the fire department. Do not move the grill. If the flame goes out, turn the grill and gas off and wait at least 15 minutes before relighting it. 6. When using a starter fluid, use only charcoal starter fluid. Never add any other flammable liquids to the fire. Keep charcoal fluid out of the reach of children and away from heat sources. When you are finished grilling, let the coals completely cool before disposing of them in a metal container. And finally, use common sense and grill safely.
Next up, we're going to be replaying one of our Best of East County episodes, our bookshelf interview with Roger Scholey, retired Union Tribune journalist, historian, and author of the San Diego Memories series.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today, I'm speaking with Roger Scholey, retired journalist from the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of 6 books, including 3 San Diego Memories volumes and 3 others on local history. My guest is also president of the Balboa Park Committee of 100 and serves on the boards of the San Diego Architectural Foundation and Friends of San Diego Architecture. That's a lot. Welcome, Roger Scholey. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Nice to be with you, Raina.
Okay, let's begin with your history. I know that you're a third generation San Diegan. You graduated from UC San Diego in 1970 with a history degree, and you've raised your family here. How did you end up as staff writer for the UT for 44 years, and ultimately your involvement in this series?
I was a reporter for the Triton Times at UCSD and was one of the founders in the 60s. And the university does not have any journalism program. So we had to self-teach ourselves how to be reporters and editors and everything else. So that's where I got my training. Then I was also a campus correspondent for the Evening Tribune for several years. And after graduation, I made my way to the UT as a reporter and started in 1974. And I've always been interested in San Diego history. Obviously, I was a history major, so that was part of my profile. And as you know, San Diego schools do very little in the way of history teaching of the local history. You only learn it in third or fourth grade, and you never hear about it, about California or San Diego again.
Right.
So a lot of this is self-learning by San Diegans. And if you're from here, you have more chance of learning about the past through your families. But for, mm-hmm. I don't know, 80% of San Diego residents, they were not born here. So they don't know innately what the place is about, which explains why we vote the way we do sometimes, mm-hmm. how we forget things that happened 20 years ago because we weren't here. And my favorite expression I hear from people is, when I moved here 5 years ago, Sandy was much better than it is today. And of course, you can hold by that 20 times for people who've moved here from one period or another. So in the newspaper, I took a special interest in covering the history of places and people that I came across. And then I started writing stories about San Diego history whenever I could, and then myself, because I didn't teach, I wasn't taught it either. Well, when I left the newspaper in March of 2018, as I was walking out the door, Jeff Light, the editor of the Union Tribune, pulled me aside and said, I have something for you to do. So he told me about this series of books by Pediment in Washington State. They have partnered with historical societies and local newspapers to do dozens and dozens of pictorial histories of their places and people and everything else. So I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So he came out with the first book in 2018 that took San Diego up to 1940. And then in 2019, I did the one from 1940 to 60. And this one that you're talking about today was 1960 to 1980. And then I have one more volume, I think, for San Diego, this particular series, 1980 to 2020. And I said, well, why do you go to 40 years period rather than 20? And the Pediment people said, as you get closer to the present, people don't think of that as history. They think of that as me. And I don't
right.
care about me because I lived through all that.
Right.
So I think that's probably one reason why we're going to pull 40 years together in quite a romp from 1980 to now. And I figured that one chapter was going to be about 2020 itself because of the pandemic. So that's the most interesting year in our lifetimes.
So we are living a fascinating history. Before we talk about the book in particular, with your perspective as a longtime journalist and a history expert, what would you say is the biggest difference that you've seen in San Diego over the years, and the biggest difference in journalism as well, if I could ask?
Of course, the biggest difference is it's grown a lot in my lifetime. I was born in 1948, so San Diego was 500,000 people about then, and now it's 1.3 million just in the city, and the county itself is 2 or 3 million. Mm-hmm. And if you bring in Tijuana, another 1.5 million, that's maybe 5 million people in our region, which is much bigger than it was 50, 75 years ago. So that's the biggest change, I think, physically in the area. The second thing is that San Diego has become a lot more diverse in terms of demographics, with a lot more ethnic variety from a wave of immigrants who've come here for the last 50 years, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then as this book told me, as I was trying to find the right pictures with the History Center and the UT helping, was the role of women in San Diego. So we went out of our way to pull out pictures of women doing all sorts of things. Same thing with minority groups, trying to highlight them, giving their due, because history is typically about white male, you know, leaders, and not much about the average person. So this book, these books are about the life of San Diego residents in all manner of speaking. So from arts to work to home life, everything is supposed to be a snapshot, series of snapshots over the last, in this case, 20 years of 1960 to 1980.
So literally the way we look at the world and evaluate it has changed.
Yeah, and then you asked about the role of the media and the newspapers in this period, 1960 to 1980. I would say that in 1960, the news was basically the Union and the Tribune. That was the main source of people's information about San Diego news. And over the following 20 years, the role of TV journalism has grown a lot more significant. They're not as thorough as the newspaper, but obviously, but people get a lot of their news from watching TV. And of course, that's not at all touching on the current period where it's all online and many other sources. But in those days, it was basically news people. Most people would take a newspaper. Most families would take San Diego Union and Tribune. And now it's many people don't take the newspaper. They get it online or they read other sources. So that's the big difference. I think the other difference in journalism over my career is that the idea of investigative journalism has become much more important than it used to be. If you go back and read the newspapers of earlier times, there was very little of that sort of thing, and analysis. There were sometimes columnists that got into some background, but the prevalence of investigative journalism was not really very active in San Diego until the 1970s. So starting in that period, when Jerry Warren became the editor in the 70s and was in the 80s, he specialized and urged us to be much more investigative in all realms of the coverage, not just big political scandals, but anything.
That explains a lot. Okay, well, let's talk about the latest book in this series, San Diego Memories 3, A Time of Change, as you mentioned, the 1960s and the 70s. You've told us a little bit about your collaboration with the San Diego History Center and the Union Tribune. Give our listeners more of a look at this volume. What's in it?
Well, there are 7 or 8 chapters, and each one has a certain focus. So let me just give you a sense of what those are. This is typically the categories that their pictorial histories include, but some of them are San Diego centric. For example, we have a military chapter, a maritime chapter that you wouldn't see in other cities. But we also, one thing I suggested we do, which is to lead off the book with activism, basically the political turmoil and craziness of the 60s and 70s. And in the foreword, I talked about that as well, saying the 60s and 70s is very much like what we've gone through in the last 4 or 5 years during the Trump administration, and a great deal of polarization and street, you know, demonstrations and sometimes violence outbursts. You know, it's just been, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, they said, this is just like it was when we were 20 years old. So it's been a rerun of historical trends of back then. There's also other non-political kinds of things in the book: sports, leisure, public service, transportation. I also wanted to do something on the seedy side of life, which is crime, scandals. We've had a number of terrible disasters in this period that people who lived here know all about. And the final chapter is about arts and culture. So we have there are about 300 pictures that are in the book, and we can talk about how we went about doing that, because it was a lot of fun and a lot of work, though.
How did you go about doing that? Tell us.
Well, I started with a timeline, because I'm a historian, so I believe in looking at history through time and chronologically. So Mary Mati Agudo, the UT archivist, has been keeping a meticulous timeline of San Diego history, starting from the beginning, and she's always updating it with events today and findings from the past that she inserts into her chronology. So I said, well, give me the 1960 to 80 time period. So I went through and I circled all the events and things that seemed to be reminding me of what happened in the news. And then we started looking for pictures along the same lines and tried to categorize all the pictures by these different chapters. And I think we ended up about 600 or 700 candidates. And then Pediment editors pulled out the ones they thought were the most compelling pictures. And that was about done in April last year. And then I went to work to research all the pictures we picked. I didn't want to do that first because I didn't want to research something that wouldn't show up in the book. So luckily I have access to the UT's digital archives back to the beginning. And so I was able to plug in an event or the date of whatever the picture was and find the story that's tied to the picture.
Wow.
Which is very much different, much more revealing than you realize, because the pictures the History Center has does not have any of that sort of information on the picture. It just says, right, seeing, you know, traffic congestion on Torrey Pines Road. Well, I looked up the picture the story that went with that is all about the congestion and that the fact the freeway was under construction nearby and that would relieve the traffic congestion. So there's lots of examples of that where the picture doesn't say 1,000 words. You have to look up the words to see the real information.
Well, I would think if you change some of the cars and the clothing, the picture might look similar to, say, a current time, but the explanation, the reason, the context is so different, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the details make the story. So I mean, sometimes these picture books that you get are not very revealing substance-wise. They're just a couple of lines about describing something that you can see just by looking at it. So I wanted to make this really a book about an information-packed book. So I hope people actually read the captions, because they're going to learn a lot about San Diego history by reading what the pictures are all about. So
it sounds like
I could have written a book about the San Diego 1960 to 80. Richard Perrault wrote a series of books for the UT back then, and he got into great detail. But after writing my other books, I began to realize people like pictures, they don't like to read, which is pathetic. But
that's another story, another interview.
So I wanted to pack in as much information as possibly could in these captions. And sometimes they went overboard and went to great lengths to check people's names and addresses, names and backgrounds, and even found obituaries of people who died who kind of revealed some information about them that wasn't evident at the time of the story, the picture that was run. And I've just found one mistake somebody sent me, which had to do with the Padres sometimes. So we do make mistakes. I tried my best to avoid them, but we did what we could to check everything out.
It sounds like a fun process overall.
It was.
Now, San Diego is famous for being called America's finest city. Do you have any historical perspective on how that came about? And if any of that is reflected, well, I'm sure it's reflected in the series, but what's the history of that?
Well, the phrase America's finest city has a very particular origin. That was the decision by the Republican National Committee to pull out the 1972 election or convention from San Diego over a series of scandals going on about that convention. So Pete Wilson was the mayor at the time, and his press assistant, Aldo Boss, a former UT reporter, wrote a speech about the what we would do in as San Diego to counteract the bad publicity that came of losing this convention. So they declared America's Finest City Week for the same week of the Republican convention. And that phrase stuck, and it became, we had America's Finest City Week for many years, and Finest City Marathon and lots of other things. But parenthetically, actually, I should admit this, at that year, I was actually working in Washington, D.C. at the Republican National Committee. So I was on the other end of the news where they decided they had to pull the convention out of San Diego and what went into trying to quickly move it to Miami Beach, which is where the Democrats had their convention as well. So I was, you know, a big booster of San Diego, and I was carrying San Diego's torch in the RNC saying, hey, that's terrible, we should stay in San Diego. And of course they didn't, but it was fun watching it from afar.
Isn't that amazing how the slogan stuck? Yeah. In Memories 3, what is your very favorite picture and caption? What makes it your favorite?
Oh, well, my favorite is on the back cover of it. And it's on, it's on page 159. And it shows two kids at Comic-Con in 1976. And they're both sitting there reading a Howard the Duck comic book, which is really, but what I love about this picture is it tells several stories. First of all, comics. Second, Comic-Con, which is a San Diego creation.
Right.
And these two boys, one black and one white, sitting there as chums reading this comic book. So if you want something symbolic about San Diego's progress and being a diverse city and a fun city and everything else, this picture says it all. So that's my all-time favorite in this book. And when I came across it, I said, this is fantastic. I tried to find these two kids, but I wasn't able to track them down.
Interesting. It sounds iconic. Yeah. Now, the architectural boards and the other committees that you're involved in, do they inspire your work? Do you think you'd be getting involved with the same projects without the involvement in all those boards?
It grew out of my job at the UT for most of my career was growth and development. And so I was very interested in San Diego's growth and its buildings and planning of San Diego and architecture and everything else. So, one feeds the other, you know, and there's a lot of development type pictures I wanted to put in this book because that's my favorite thing is how San Diego grew physically. And so when I serve on those two groups and the Committee of 100 in Balboa Park, always being mindful of San Diego's architecture and the need to save pieces of the past, because if you don't have them, you don't think about the past. So there's been this book has some of that in here, some historic preservation mentions. And so in the 1960s, that's actually when the whole U.S. became much more interested in historic preservation than it had been in the past. And the federal government passed a law creating the National Register of Historic Places. And San Diego created its historic site board, and other groups like Save Our Heritage Organization were formed at the time. In our group, the Committee of 100 at Balboa Park, also in the 1960s, because while San Diego was rushing ahead in the 60s and 70s with growth and development and thousands of people moving here and building new subdivisions all over the place, it also had a very valuable elements from the past to save. And the Gaston Quarter, for example, was the association was founded in the 70s to save those buildings on Fifth Avenue downtown. And some buildings were lost, and we show pictures of that. Mm-hmm. But others have been saved or restored or reconstructed. So we still have a lot to look to, but we've lost quite a lot of important buildings, including this year, the stadium's being demolished. You know, I mentioned there's a nice pictures of the stadium being built in 1965 to 67, mm-hmm. but the next volume will show the stadium be demolished. You know, this to me, that's one of the great crazy things about San Diego is we build something and 50 years later, we throw it away. Horton Plaza Shopping Center is going through right now. So this is history in the making. That's what, it's an American thing to throw away the past and don't remember it. That's good and bad in some ways.
Yeah, that leads me to, I guess, the question, why does it matter? Why is it so important for us to look back as well as forward?
Well, there's the usual statement that if you forget the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, you never repeat the history. It never happens that way. But there's certain things that come up in one time, and then a couple of generations later, we find it up again. I mean, this whole thing of right now we're going through with the Republican Party trying to battle back the QAnon people just shows you how dangerous forgetting the past can be. I mean, I was thinking, you know, now we know why Hitler was able to take over Germany with a minority of people, because the vast majority of Germans didn't take him seriously. Well, this is exactly what we're witnessing today with this whole battle of the QAnon people and the fake news people and all that. They just pick their own facts or create them or invent them. And if the public doesn't educate itself, they're going to be, you know, going to face some totalitarian results in the U.S. Yeah. In the rest of the world, you know, that they were surprised the U.S. came this way. But if you read American history, we've had this sort of thing happen over and over again.
Right.
From the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, all of our battles have had this sort of conflict between groups, between regions, between people, between generations. This is nothing new. If you don't read you don't learn the history, you're gonna make the wrong decisions, I think, and when you go to the ballot box. So I wish that we would have. Well, Texas apparently is a very good state for learning, teaching local history, state history, partly because they were a separate country for some years in the 1830s and 40s. But California doesn't take any of that seriously. So there was a lot of talk and action at the state level in California in order to make people more aware of diversity and minority groups and their contributions to California. I'm hoping that effort broadens out to the general story of California and San Diego and other localities, because we could use a lot more real knowledge of that personally than we do now.
Yeah, so let's hope history finds its way back into all levels of schooling, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It never was. I mean, actually, it's never been a priority in the sense I'm talking about. So,
okay, good point.
It'd be nice to take that on.
Very good. I've got one last question for you. Tell us just a little bit more about what you're working on now and when we can expect to see it in print.
Okay, well, the plan is this year, which I haven't started yet, to work on the last copy of the last entry in the series, San Diego Memories, 1980 to 2020. And it's going to take in the same categories as we've had in the past. As I said at the outset, I think one chapter probably will be devoted to the pandemic year, because that is just an amazing thing that happened here and around the country, around the world. So just as we had an activism chapter in the 1960 to 80 book, I think 2020 will be sort of the opening chapter of the story, because even though it's contemporary, it's going to be something everyone remember forever, I think.
Right.
So I'm going to go through with Mary and start with the chronology of the last 40 years and start to pick out pictures. Now, the difference between this book and the last ones was the History Center had a wealth of 2 or 3 million images that we could draw from. They've all been cataloged. You could just go on their website and find pictures, and which I did. They don't have virtually anything from 1980 because their collection is mostly Union Tribune negatives and photos. So those were the core pictures in this book and all the other books, to the extent we had them. The new issue, the news book, is going to be totally relying on UT file photos, and I don't have access to them at my home computer yet. I hope I can, because otherwise Mary's going to do all the work finding them. But it's going to make it, it'll be similarly organized by finding the pictures, tracking down the stories that go with the pictures, and then writing the captions to go with them. So I think they'll, if everything goes well, we'll finish this by in time for the holidays this coming year.
I can't wait to see it. I think it will be a fascinating enterprise choosing the cover picture. There's so many choices.
I've been thinking about this. And what is the, what is the one, and in this case, the picture we did in this book was John F. Kennedy at a pre-election rally in San Diego in 1960 during the presidential campaign. We picked that. I said, gee, what happens if Trump gets reelected? This will look kind of strange to have Kennedy on the cover, but it was a time of change. He was a new generation, you know, so that in many ways that was a very good choice for this book. But for the 1980 to 2020, I mean, there's so many possibilities, and right. It's somewhat inspiring, not a negative thing, but some, because we could have all kinds of pictures on the cover that are kind of scary,
right?
Or we could have something that's in ennobling, you might say,
so inspiring or hopeful at least.
Yeah. So I will just kind of, I mean, you could have someone with a shot in the arm or getting a virus,
right?
That
right.
A little bit too
right.
Specific, but we'll find something will come out. And what happens is Pediment goes through and picks all the pictures and puts them in the layout, and then they come up. They pick several of them as potential cover pictures, and we all weigh in on which ones we think are the best, and then they pick the one because they're in charge.
Well, if you need another vote, let me know.
Okay.
Roger, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you too, Raina.
To contact Roger Scholey, please write him at rmscholey, that's Scholey, at yahoo.com.
Oh, we should also mention how people can get the book, because it isn't available in stores. So they can get it online by going to pediment.com. That's the publisher. And you could write me if you want to get a copy that I can autograph. So you can send me a request as well.
Very good. An autographed copy for your coffee table.
Right.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.